As we continue our studies of Old Testament history this morning, I want to fast forward from the actual flood recorded in Genesis 7 to the aftermath in Genesis chapter 8 and following. I'm doing this for two reasons. First of all, as I've said a few times now, my intention is not to conduct an expository series on the entire Old Testament. As informative as that would be, as fun as that might sound, I have no intention of doing an expository study of everything between Genesis and Malachi. That would take way too long. And besides, my point in doing these Old Testament studies is really to familiarize all of us a little bit more with some of the things that are often missed in our simple reading of the Old Testament and certainly in our study of the Old Testament in general. Really, there's a second reason I'm not going to go too in-depth here, and that's because there's really not much more to say about the flood beyond what we've already talked about concerning the days leading up to it. The rain began to fall. The rain fell torrentially for 40 days until even the tallest mountains were covered. Every living thing died except for Noah and his seven family members and the creatures that were with them on the ark. The water, we're told, prevailed on the earth for 150 days before God caused a wind to pass over the earth, which began to dry things out. On the 17th day of the seventh month, which according to ancient Jewish tradition corresponds to the month of Abib, the ark is said to have come to rest upon the mountains of Ararat. Now, just a really fascinating aside here, what's really, in my mind at least, kind of mind-boggling about this particular day, the 17th of Abib, which, by the way, corresponds with the 17th day of April in our modern calendars, this is the same day that the Israelites are said to have passed over the Red Sea on dry land. It's also the same day that, according to Jewish reckoning, Jesus rose again from the dead. It doesn't really require an in-depth lesson on Christology or on history at all, especially in terms of types and shadows. That's a pretty blatant example of how history can repeat itself in very important ways, especially redemptive history. I mean, think about it in human terms. What are the odds that the ark would come to rest on the mountains of Ararat on the same day that would later be the day commemorating the Jews crossing the Red Sea on dry land and Jesus himself being raised from the dead? The indications are pretty clear that this was a very important day on God's calendar in terms of his redemptive plan. Now, a lot of you might, if you're especially on the ball, you might argue that Jesus was actually crucified not during the month of Abib, but during the month of Nisan. There's an easy explanation for this. The month called Abib, that's its historical, ancient name. This name would later be changed by the Babylonians when they took the Jews into captivity. They changed the name of the month from Abib to Nisan. And so when we read that Jesus was crucified on the 14th day of Nisan, it's the same as saying that he was crucified on the 14th of Abib, and he was actually raised from the dead on the 17th of Abib. So again, very fascinating, at least in my estimation. Now, there's another thing here that you need to note, and that is that I think without exception, most of your translations refer to the place where the ark came to rest as the mountains of Ararat. There are a lot of people who have fallen hook, line, and sinker for the many documentaries that are out there that insist that they've actually found Noah's ark on Mount Ararat proper, which is in eastern Turkey. And those are very convincing arguments. There's convincing photos of what people think they can see in various land formations and so on and so forth. I've looked at the pictures. I really don't see it. I don't really place a lot of credence in that. And it's really not because of the photographic evidence or the lack thereof. The reason I don't place too much credence on that particular argument is because the mountains of Ararat were made up of a range that extended from eastern Turkey all the way up to Syria, over to Syria, and then up even into Asia, according to some historians. Wherever the ark actually came to rest, we're really not told the exact location. Now, I will say this about that. There are varying traditions that suggest that the ark has in fact been located at various points in history anywhere along that mountain range. So again, I wouldn't place too much credence on that at all. Wherever it came to rest, though, we're told in Genesis 8:5 that the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. On the first day of the 10th month, the tops of the other mountains became visible. And it was at this point that Noah actually opened the window of the ark and sent out a raven. The raven, as you know, went out and flew hither and yon and always came back. He sent out a dove. The dove went out and flew around, and at least during the first iteration of this experiment, the dove came back to roost on the ark. He then sent out another dove, or perhaps the same dove, 7 days later. This time the dove returned with a freshly picked olive leaf in her beak, which indicated to Noah that the water had, in fact, abated. He waited another 7 days. He sent the dove out again, and the dove did not return, indicating that the dove found a suitable place to roost. Now, there are some who are particularly skeptical when they read the flood narrative, and they'll say, well, it's really kind of unbelievable that a dove would find an olive branch so soon after the flood. In other words, you know, the water has just receded. Everything's still muddy and in a state of relative chaos as far as the life that existed on the mountains that were visible. And some people say, you know, it's really not feasible that only a few months after the catastrophic flood had wiped out every living thing. It's really unfeasible that there would be an olive tree even in existence. I don't know how much you really know about botany, but there have been several Christian botanists and even non-Christian botanists who say this is not really as preposterous as a lot of people might suppose. They have actually done experiments where they flood certain plants, the olive tree being one of them. And if, in the event of a catastrophic flood, you can imagine that the olive trees that existed and every other plant that existed was probably swept away, including the roots. The olive tree, in particular, has a root ball that is able to survive for years and years if left alone. We all know the process of death and germination of seeds and how you can have a package of seeds that lays dormant for any number of decades and still be able to plant those seeds and have them come to life. So in this case, many of these Christian botanists have surmised that it's quite possible when the flood swept away all of the flora and all of the fauna that, you know, these plants were probably littering the surface of the water while the ark made its way to its destination. When the floodwaters receded, where did that detritus land? It landed right on the ground. It wouldn't be that big a stretch to have plants within weeks after the flood finally coming to rest. There's actually been an experiment in Australia where there was a dam that had been, it was a man-made reservoir, and this dam was holding back all the water. And during a particularly severe drought, the water dried up. And in places where the water dried up, having covered the land for 20 to 30 years, in those places where the water dried up, the plants that were particularly indigenous to that area within a week or two began to sprout again in the areas where the water had been inundating those things for that number of years. It's a fascinating study, but again, the skeptics like to point out that, no, I don't think the dove would have a chance of finding an olive branch, you know, so soon after the flood. He or she probably would have had no problem finding some type of plant life, even at that early date. Now, after waiting for some time in the ark, the day came when God spoke to Noah. He said, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. Noah and his family and the animals and their families then left the ark. And what's the first thing Noah did by way of worshiping? Yeah, he created an altar. He created an altar, and on this altar, he presented burnt offerings to the Lord from every clean animal and bird. Now again, if the Bible was a book that man actually wrote without any component of divine inspiration, what might we expect to read in the narrative that follows? You know, I've told you before, the Bible is neither a book that man would write if he could or could write if he would. If man had written the story, especially the story of redemptive history, it would be much different than what it appears in the Scriptures, would it not? Of course it would. How do we know? We know because we've got scads of other purported redemptive histories concerning other religions throughout the world. And there's always a common denominator throughout all of those things. God is angry. Man appeases God's wrath. Man lives happily ever after as long as he continues to appease God's wrath. You know, this is true of the volcano gods. This is true of all the false gods that have existed throughout pagan worship. There's a common theme that runs through it. In this case, we might expect, if man had written this, that God would have been satisfied with Noah's offering. And that's anthropomorphically clear in the first part of verse 21. But what would man have given us as God's response there in verse 21b? I think he would have said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart has changed, and because I have effectively reset man's disposition to that which is good and righteous, I will never again destroy the living thing, every living thing as I have done. Right? In fact, if you talk to even a lot of professing believers today, they believe the rainbow that God set in the clouds as a promise that he would never flood the earth again, they believe that that rainbow is actually a promise that God will never exact his judgment on the earth again. I've actually talked to people who believe that. You ask them, what does the rainbow represent? Well, that's God's promise that he'll never again destroy the earth. They obviously haven't read the end of the book, right? But what did God say instead? Listen very carefully. He said, I will never again curse the ground on account of man. Now get this. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. Now wait a minute. Had God not just destroyed the earth and every living thing in it because of man's evil intent? Did God not say in Genesis 6, I'm sorry I made man? Yes. And then he destroyed the earth and everything in it because of man's evil intent. And now after the flood, he's saying that the intent of man's heart is still evil from his youth? Is that what he's saying? What man is he talking about? Well, he can only be talking about one of four men. Noah and his three sons. This naturally included their wives as well. He's talking about the only people who still existed at the time. He's talking about Noah and his family. The intent of their hearts was still evil. Now, wait a minute. I thought Noah was spared on the basis of his righteousness. You've heard that before as well, right? You read repeatedly throughout the Old Testament, so-and-so was righteous, so-and-so was righteous, so-and-so was righteous. And they were. But on the basis of what? Were they righteous in and of themselves? No. As a matter of fact, if they were, then that would negate Paul's statement in Romans 3 that there are none righteous. No, not one. What Paul's implication there is that there never has been anyone righteous. No, not one, except the righteous one himself, Jesus Christ. So when we read passages like that tell us things like Noah was righteous, Enoch walked with God and he was no more, we need not equate these behaviors and these attitudes of these men as sinless perfection. It's just not true. Back in Genesis 6:9, we're told that Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God. But what does that really mean? Herein lies the fundamental misunderstanding of all that happened in the flood. Noah wasn't spared because he was righteous in and of himself. He was spared because he was numbered among God's elect from before the foundation of the world and had thus been clothed in Christ's righteousness. But wait a minute, Christ had not come yet. Christ had not died yet. Christ had not been raised from the dead yet. It doesn't matter. Remember, the people of faith, and we know that what Noah did, he did by faith. Look at Hebrews 11 and you'll see that clearly. What kind of faith? Faith that he had innately? No. Faith that was given to him by God himself on the basis of his having been numbered among God's elect from before the foundation of the world, being secured in the finished work of Jesus Christ that was yet to come. Would any of us dare argue that Noah was sinless? Anybody want to go down that road? Let's suppose for a moment he was. Let's just, you know, for the sake of argument, let's say Noah was sinless. What about his wife and his sons and their wives? Are we to believe that they were all sinless? No, as a matter of fact, we know they weren't. And riddle me this, if it's true, and it is, that even the smallest of sins among humankind is sufficient to warrant the wrath and judgment of God, we know that Noah and his family were deserving of that same fate because they undoubtedly sinned at some point. Again, the problem that many have in understanding this stems from the fact that they remember Genesis 6:9, but not Genesis 6:7 and 8. Go ahead and turn there. Genesis 6:7 and 8. I realize we just covered this, but I do want you to see the flaw in the thought process of many. Genesis 6, verse 7. The Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But, as Luther said, that tiny little hinge upon which great doctrines swing. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was nothing more, nothing less than a trophy of God's grace. Noah, like every other saint, was saved by grace through faith, and that not of himself, as the Apostle Paul tells us in Ephesians 2, lest he should be able to boast. The entire reason Noah and his family were spared from death during the flood was so that God's plan of redemption, which includes his wrath and judgment upon those who are not his children, which also includes the truth of the incredibly narrow way that leads to life and the broad way that leads to destruction, the entire reason Noah and his family were spared from death was so that God's plan of redemption could be seen by future generations as a mere foreshadowing of what awaits the whole of humankind at a still future time. what God says to himself in Genesis 8:21b is intended to deflect and correct the erroneous notion that man had fundamentally changed with regard to original sin simply because Noah and his family had been spared. It's very important that we understand this. The story of Noah and his redemption, his being spared from the flood, is not a do-over. The story of Noah and his family being spared from the flood was not a mulligan, if you're a golf fan. They didn't get to start over with Noah. It's not like God said, well, I messed up the first time, let me see if the second time works any better. Noah, I'm going to scare the wits out of you and your family. You're going to straighten up and fly right once you land where I put you. It's not that at all. Again, the whole reason Noah and his family went through what they went through was because God wanted to make the point that man was sinful and there would be an ultimate price to pay should he not be covered by God's grace. The whole flood account is just a foreshadowing of the ultimate destruction that is yet to come. Oh, but surely God wouldn't wipe out a whole world full of people and save just 8 people just to make a theological point. Yes, he would. Well, how can he do that? Because he's God. Well, I would never. Of course you wouldn't. You're not God. We can all learn a valuable lesson, right? Couple of valuable lessons from the flood narrative, from the relatively few people, the astronomically few people who were saved from the flood. When you compare that with the population of the earth that was probably in existence at the time. Some anthropologists, again, have speculated that the earth could have very well been populated with billions of people. And again, this just drives home the point of how narrow that way to salvation is. And the fact that there are few who find it. If you don't understand Jesus' words in the New Testament, you've got a vivid picture in the Old Testament that describes just how narrow that way can be. Well, when God says that He'll never again curse the ground or destroy every living thing, note carefully how He qualifies that statement. He's not saying that He would never again curse the ground or destroy every living thing. He says, I will never do that again as I have done. He's simply promising that He wouldn't destroy every living thing in the same way ever again. This is actually made clear in the next chapter. Following his explanation concerning the dietary restrictions that were to be observed by Noah and his family and the prohibition against murder, I'll be discussing those in a little more detail in just a minute. But God established his covenant with them. And what does he promise them in Genesis 9:11? He says, never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And then in verses 12 through 17, God explains that the sign of the covenant would be the rainbow in the cloud. And that rainbow is intended to serve as a vivid reminder of His covenantal faithfulness to them. Even though man himself would continue to be sinful and rebellious, there would always be a remnant of God's people on the earth who have been made partakers of this covenant of grace. You know, one of the most heinous displays of the rainbow today, of course, is how it's attached to the LGBTQRSTUVXYZ bizarre thing that we see in the world today. You know, and people are often aghast at You know, I get asked fairly often, especially, you know, during so-called Gay Pride Month, why we can just sit back and let them use the rainbow, the sign of God's covenant of grace to His people. Folks, again, this is a case where we shouldn't be surprised. I'll say it again. Don't be surprised. Stop being surprised when lost people act lost. The first clue that we should have is that the month itself is even called Gay Pride Month. Pride is a sin. But they have no problem saying that they're proud in their sin. That should be your first clue. So don't be surprised if they've hijacked the rainbow as a symbol of their own movement. It just goes to show how depraved man actually is. And at the same time, let me be careful to point out that we also shouldn't be on hobby horses with regard to certain pet sins that we find particularly egregious. That particular sin and all of its manifestations is no more heinous than the sins that many of you are still engaged in this morning. Once again, we have this penchant for racking and stacking sins according to what we find most detestable. And those are the ones we speak out most often against. And then those in those particular sins, you know, are quick to point out the fact that most of the people who call out their sins are themselves hypocrites. And I've said this before as well, the reason people call us hypocrites as believers is because, by and large, it's true. We have a lot of speck and beam theology that we need to address, don't we? We're quick to call out the speck in other people's eyes when we have this huge log in our own. I'm not saying we don't speak out about those things. We do, and we should. But not in such a way as to cast those people involved in those things in a separate class of sinners that should be reviled by us. What should our response be to them? The gospel, which is the greatest manifestation of love that we can show them. We're going to talk about this in the next hour. We're going to talk about how sanctification actually produces the kind of love that God Himself has shed abroad in our hearts as believers. And the great need that we all have to hone that love, to cultivate that kind of love, even for my enemies, yes. Even for those with whom I disagree most vehemently, yes. Sad to say, but I need to say it, the Bible nowhere gives you permission to be a knucklehead. Right? Well, there's a lot more that meets the eye in verses 1 through 7, so let's back up a bit. Let's talk about something here. When God tells Noah and his sons that every beast of the earth, every bird of the air, the fish of the sea, and everything else that moves on the earth was to be food for them, along with the herbs that would be used to season it all. As we discussed early on in our study, this could be the first time man's actually permitted to eat meat. Could be. The reason I say could be is because theologians are at odds with one another with regard to this thing. Many theologians, myself included, leave open the possibility that these instructions are just a reiteration of the instructions originally given to Adam and Eve. And this would help explain why Abel's sacrifice was of the firstlings and fatlings of his flock. We tend to believe that those probably would have been burnt offerings as well, and that they would have eaten the meat. That's been the standard modus operandi of the people of God, I believe, ever since Cain and Abel, at least. But I'll leave open the possibility this might be the first time that man is allowed to eat meat. We just don't know for sure. What we do know is that this is the first example of dietary stipulations that God does proactively place on His people. Now again, we can surmise all day long what they ate prior to the flood, what Adam and Eve ate, what they were allowed to eat. We know that they were able to eat of any tree or plant in the garden except from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's when things came crashing down, when they did that. We don't really know what else they ate, but we do know from this passage, this seems to be the first indication that God gave of dietary stipulations. And what was the particular dietary stipulation put into place here? Well, they were permitted to eat the herbs, the plants, the whatever the trees produced, and the meat, but not the blood. Right? Not the blood. Why? Let me just throw that out there, huh? Okay, the in the blood is the life. Sorry, honey, but that doesn't. Anybody else have any good ideas? For those of you listening, this is my better half, my wife. She has a tendency to jump ahead. Anybody else give me a reason why blood was not allowed to be consumed? Okay. Seen as unclean, diseases are carried in the blood. Yes, Rosie. Ooh, it's what the Gentiles do. Only thing, there were no Gentiles around at this time. We're talking about eight people, yeah. Yes, funny. Yes, but what does that mean? Don't feel bad, I didn't really know either. I'm like, what does that even mean? The life is in the blood, right? I mean, we read things in the scriptures oftentimes and we think, well, yeah, I know what that means. The life's in the blood. And then somebody says, well, what does that mean? I don't really know what that means. There's no harm in that, right? The reason I believe that Noah and his family were prohibited, and this would carry over into the Jewish culture as well, the reason I believe that they were prohibited from eating of the blood was because I believe even at this early stage of the unfolding of God's plan of redemption, God wanted Noah and his sons to begin seeing the blood as having salvific implications. It probably wasn't because there was disease in the blood, which it's a possibility, but it could have been for other reasons, I suppose. But I think the overarching reason is because God wanted them to begin thinking, even at this very early stage, about the salvific implications of blood itself. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, look over at Leviticus 17. Leviticus 17. Of course, this is sometime later, much later, but it does make a little clearer what God's mind is with regard to the blood. Genesis, or Leviticus 17, verse 10. God says, any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood, by reason of the life, that makes atonement. When we say that the life is in the blood, what we mean is that the blood always represents the life that was both lived and the life that was given for a particular purpose. So they were to see the life as indicating that in order for them to be atoned, to have their sin covered, to have their sin propitiated, that had to take place via the blood. You know, we have, many of us have come up in more fundamental backgrounds where there's a big deal made about the blood itself, the blood of Christ. And John MacArthur got in huge trouble back in the 70s and 80s for saying that it's not actually the blood of Christ, it's the death, burial, the resurrection of Christ, which secures our eternity. John's absolutely correct. The blood, even as early as Leviticus 17, was representative of the life that was given. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. What does that mean? You know, does that mean that Jesus could have just, I don't know, pricked his finger and bled a little bit, and that would have atoned for all the sins of mankind? No. Again, because the significance of the letting, the shedding of the blood, was the death of the one that shed the blood. There's no great sacrifice made when you prick your finger and bleed out a little bit. None at all. There's great sacrifice. You know, if that be the case, the Jews could have very well been instructed to take their unblemished lambs, take them to some place, you know, remote where the altar was, and then just, I don't know, prick their little feet and make it bleed and bleep, bleep, there's the blood for the sacrifice. That was never God's intent. God's intent always involved death. Sacrificial death. Which is represented again by blood. Jesus' shed blood does not speak to some magical, mystical property that was in his hemoglobin. The shed blood of Christ refers to his sacrificial death as the spotless Lamb of God. Right? We need to understand that. That's why one of my least favorite hymns, "There is a fountain filled with blood that flows from Emmanuel's veins." No, there's not. That song, I believe, is an insult. I get what the song's saying. You know, I suppose it's the idea that the blood of Christ, the death of Christ, the atoning work of Christ never runs out. We can always tap into that. I get that. But to me, it's a bit macabre to say that there's this fountain filled with blood that continually flows from Emmanuel's veins. My Bible tells me that once he made atonement through his blood, through his death, he sat down forever at the right hand of majesty on high, and he sits there even today, not bleeding. I almost came up with a very clever Southern Baptist. He's not bleeding, he's pleading. Never mind. Yeah. And John groans. I think it was this understanding in Leviticus 17. I think it was this understanding promoted even to Noah at this early stage. I think it was this that formed the basis for the entire sacrificial system that the Jews observed for centuries. Earlier in the book of Leviticus, you can see countless references to the shedding of blood, and the high priest, the Levitical priest, would take the blood in a laver or a bowl, and he would take it into the temple or even into the tabernacle early on, and he would get a branch of hyssop, and he would dip it in the blood, and he'd sprinkle it all over everything in there, indicating that everything was to be covered by the atoning blood of the sacrifice. He would then go out to the people and sprinkle the blood on them in an effort to atone for their sins as well. When the children of Israel were in captivity in Egypt and the death angel was sent by the Lord to kill the firstborn in all of Egypt, the children of God, the Israelites, were instructed to do what? They were instructed to kill a lamb, take the blood of the lamb, and do what with it? Paint the doorposts and the lintels of their house so that when the death angel passed by, he would see that they were covered by the blood. This was a bloody sacrifice, and this was the only thing that would appease the wrath of God. And what did that blood signify? It was a foreshadowing, right? It's a picture of Christ who was to come. Every observant, faith-filled Jew at that time knew exactly what was going on. Just as Abraham knew and his faith was reckoned to him as righteousness, every Jew knew, we're doing this because there is one yet to come who will shed his blood once for all. We're doing this because we remember God's promise to redeem us. And perhaps we even remember back as far as Noah when this whole thing was set up to remind us of God's perfect Lamb who is to come. This is exactly what the writer of the Hebrews was talking about when he wrote about the built-in futility of the sacrificial system. Remember when he talks about that in Hebrews 10, verses 1 through 4? He says, "For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of the things, the law itself can never, with these same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year, make those who approach perfect. For then they would have ceased to be offered." See, right there you can see the built-in futility of the sacrificial system. If the sacrificial system was more than just a foreshadowing and was in and of itself a means of forestalling the wrath of God, a means of becoming right with God, then all they would have had to do once in their lives, was to make a sacrifice, apply the blood to themselves, they'd be done. That's not the way it works, right? This is why the writer of the Hebrews says, "For then they would have not ceased to be offered. For the worshipers, once purified, would have no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices," he says, "there's a reminder of sins every year." It's a reminder. It's a foreshadowing. He says, "For it's not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins." So again, I believe the reason Noah and his family were commanded to abstain from eating the blood of the animals they used for food was because even at the early stage of their landing on the mountains of Ararat, God wanted them to begin to see blood as something special, something that would serve as an integral part of God's plan of redemption. As the writer of the Hebrews wrote one chapter earlier in Hebrews 9, 11 through 14, unlike the countless earthly priests whose service only foreshadowed that which would be made complete in Christ, he says this, "Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. He entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, how much more should that cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" It's all about the blood of Christ. It's not about the blood of the shadows, the blood of the types. Those things only pointed to Christ as the ultimate sacrifice for our sins. We were reminded only recently in our studies of 1 Peter in chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. We learned there that we're not redeemed with corruptible things like gold or silver, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. The blood that Noah and his family were prohibited from eating was a picture, a foreshadowing of the precious blood of Christ. Yeah, Irma. No, he just said flesh and bone. Very common idiom. Yeah, he wasn't arguing that he no longer had blood. No. It was not necessary that he bleed out. Again, that's not the point. The point is that he died. Yeah. Steve. Yeah. Yeah, what Steve's saying is, you know, the people that lived back then understood that the loss of too much blood led to death. They were able to make that equation. Interestingly enough, some of the earliest civilizations, the Egyptians among those earliest civilizations, practiced embalming. And the embalming fluid that they used had a remarkable ability to preserve tissues in the body. But they didn't do it really for that reason. The reason they embalmed the body is because they were convinced that since there was no blood, the blood had dried up, or, you know, the blood had been let out of the whole body, they needed to replace that with some kind of fluid, because they naturally, instinctively understood and made that connection with blood and life. Not that they thought that the exchange of fluids would lead to life, but they did very firmly believe in the fact that you needed those fluids in order to go to the afterlife and live successfully. So it's very interesting, yeah, that you would say that, even at that early stage of history. Well, the prohibition against eating of blood, being that representative teaching of the atoning work of Christ, that's one reason that they were taught about the preciousness of blood. The second reason is that God also wanted Noah and his sons to understand the heinousness of murder, which most of the time involved the spilling of man's blood, right? The life is in the blood. That also means that once all the blood's gone, there's no more life, right? And so, at the same time, they're being shown this picture of the atonement that would come in the Lamb of God, His shed blood. There's also a teaching here, a teaching moment here, on the prohibition against murder. In fact, in verses 6 and 7 of Genesis 9, we see the first institution of a civil magistrate. This is another one of those things that can be missed if we're not very careful as we go through this. When God tells Noah and his sons that whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, what's God doing? He's giving his permission for man to govern his own affairs. He's giving man permission to act in accordance with his decree. You know, it's not as if a man commits murder, God immediately comes down and murders that person. God says, you're going to govern this process yourself. Whenever a man's blood is shed, then the one that shed that blood, murder, his blood will be shed also. Now again, we're going to develop this a lot further as we move through our studies of Old Testament history. It does become clearer and clearer and clearer. Yeah, Mark. Yeah, that's a really interesting conversation. At the Jerusalem Council, you'll really understand this much more effectively if you understand what was going on that necessitated the Jerusalem Council. It was the influx of Judaizers who began to tell even Gentile believers. Peter was among these, by the way. So was Saul early on. They began to tell Gentile believers that in order to be right with God, you need to become a Jew, effectively. Which means you need to be observant to all of the rules and regulations within Judaism. When the apostles came to Jerusalem and met there with James at the Jerusalem church, and they all decided what the stipulations should be, they knew that they could not rid themselves of every tenet of Judaism, right? They knew that in order to keep a lot of the Jews on board, they had to make certain concessions. At that time, in history, they still shared a common belief in the preciousness of blood, the significance of blood. Remember, this is very early in redemptive history itself, at least in New Testament, New Covenant redemptive history. And so they still needed to emphasize, to a great extent, the shed blood of Christ and the importance of the blood as an atonement factor in our salvation. And so, you know, the Jerusalem Council made a concession so that they wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Remember, they had a hard time early on in the church determining what pieces of Judaism do we leave intact, what do we not leave intact. You're just seeing evidence of that. What you're not seeing is an abiding principle. And those of you who love steak, you're going to be especially grateful now. It's okay to eat a steak medium rare. Yeah, rare. You know, now that the blood of the covenant has been made clear, now that we understand the principle, there's really not so much prohibition. Now, there are dietary considerations you probably should make. You can get really sick by eating undercooked beef and other things. But I know a lot of professing believers want to take the church back to the Old Testament dietary laws. No. No. Remember, they all served a purpose. And by and large, they all pointed to something greater. That greater has come. You ever wonder why Jesus said He had come with a better covenant? Well, I mean, there's a myriad reasons for that, but one of the biggest reasons for that is because we're no longer encumbered by all of that, all the types and the shadows and the gyrations and Judaistic gymnastics that they had to commit themselves to in order to prove themselves righteous. Now we're saved by faith. Right? Saved by grace through faith in Christ alone, for the glory of God alone, as we read in the Scriptures alone. Yeah, Rosie. Yes. Yes. When Jesus was asked to clarify the law, you know, what's the greatest commandment? You know what the Jews expected to hear? And they expected to hear the whole list and the 615 other laws that they had developed. They expected Jesus would get on board and say, yeah, all these things that you teach, they're all necessary. What did He say? He just boiled it down to two. He says, in fact, let me summarize the two tables of the law. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. That's on the first table of the law. Right? And love your neighbor as yourself. Then, of course, you got the knuckleheads out there, you know, who were saying, well, who's my neighbor? You know. Yeah. We all know how that turned out. So, yes, you're touching on that, yes. Yeah. Anyway, moving right along. The fact that sin was still a problem can easily be seen in what follows in the Genesis narrative, right? Noah and his three sons, starting in verse 18 of Genesis 9 and following that. Once life began to return to some semblance of normality, what did Noah do? He became a farmer. What kind of farmer? Grapes. Noah, at some point, overindulged in his own produce. He got drunk. See? Now you've jumped ahead. Shh. Just kidding. Had Noah been a righteous man in the way that many people think that he was righteous, sinless perfection, he wouldn't have got drunk. I've even heard people try to explain, well, he didn't know. Give me a break. And sorry to my IFB people out there. It wasn't real wine. Well, it was real enough for him to get drunk. And he got drunk and he went and passed out in his tent. It's really what the language used there indicates. He passed out. He was uncovered. He was naked. That's a sin in and of itself, right? And then his brother, or his son, Ham, the joker, obviously, of the family, instead of covering his father up, what does he do? He comes out and tells the guys, hey, guys, come look at this. Come look at Pops. He's in there passed out. That's ridicule. That's uncovering their father's shame. That is also a sin. So sin is alive and well at this point. Lest we get the idea that they lived in this sinless utopia by this point, that they got a do-over. No, just like the Lord said after the flood, man's heart is still wicked. Which does what? That magnifies the grace of God, doesn't it? The fact that God could have removed every human being. You know, God could have done that. He could have destroyed everything and everyone and truly started over again. If you're a dispensationalist, that might make sense. But it doesn't to me, because God's plan of redemption has been set in stone before man ever was placed on this earth. This is all in accordance with His perfect plan of redemption. We just get to see it unfolding. Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on their shoulders, and they walked backward into the tent to cover their father's nakedness. We're also told that they intentionally turned their faces away so that they wouldn't open themselves up for ridiculing their father, shaming him in his sin. Well, what happened when Noah woke up? Yeah, they heard about it. We're going to talk about that next time, Lord willing.